This week on the Best of Flashpoints, an eyewitness account from inside a home being raided by the Israeli military in a West Bank village. Former high-level CIA analyst Ray McGovern speaks out against AIPAC and its attack against Chaz Freeman. Catherine Austin Fitz talks about Bernie Madoff and some new revelations from Seymour Hersh about a Bush administration executive assassination ring. Kevin Pina reports on the current situation on the ground in Haiti, where 15,000 people turned out to protest former President Bill Clinton and Ban Ki-moon. Dennis Bernstein, Nora Barrows-Friedman, and Kevin Pina are coming up with all this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned.
In Berkeley, I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. In occupied Palestine, the U.S.-backed Israeli government is rapidly expanding plans to expropriate and steal more Palestinian land in the West Bank and inside East Jerusalem. Just in the past few days, the Israeli military is especially targeting the Silwan village in East Jerusalem, calling for the demolition of 88 buildings in the Bustan neighborhood, which houses 115 Palestinian families. Palestinian human rights organizations estimate that over 1,500 people will be made homeless and that these homes were inherited from their parents and grandparents and constructed before the Israeli state was created in 1948. Similar plans for demolitions await Palestinian residents of the nearby Wad Hilwa neighborhood, also in Silwan village. And south of Silwan, in the West Bank village of Beit Omar, Israeli military forces announced that it will be building a fence along the settler road that runs on the edge of the village. The fence, Israel says, will be 300 meters long and will, quote, offer protection to the settlers who use the road to travel between the illegal Gush Etzion settlement colony block and Hebron colonies. And in Jerusalem today, a group of 30 extremist Israeli settlers stormed the courtyard of the Al-Aqsa Mosque in the Old City. Palestinian worshippers said that the group were disguised as tourists, and as soon as they were at the main courtyard, they started to conduct prayers for the Jewish holiday of Purim. Joining us just before airtime from the occupied West Bank was our special correspondent, Becca Wolf. Becca is the co-founder of the Palestine Solidarity Project based in the village of Beit Omar. Flashpoints caught up with Becca at the same time that an Israeli military unit invaded the home of that village's mayor, from where Becca was speaking to us. Listen to this.
This is Becca Wolf. I'm in the house of the mayor of Beit Omar, which is a village in the West Bank. Right now I'm standing just outside the front door, and I have Israeli soldiers walking past me, trying to go up to the roof. I've got kids crying behind me. The house is full of family members and neighborhood people who have come to help repair a wall in the mayor's house. The mayor is talking to the soldiers in Hebrew, telling them that he's the mayor of the village and that they've just invaded his home. They've bypassed his main home but have now gone up the stairs towards the roof.
And what is their intention in doing that, Becca?
It doesn't seem that they have a particular intention. They told us that they're looking for kids who are throwing stones. The house is full of adults, and the only person that was on the balcony or anywhere near any windows was me taking photographs. They just before they came to this house, they were at a house across the street where they banged on the front doors of that house, and when nobody answered, they left it. He's now pushing. We have a soldier who's now pushing the mayor, trying to push him into the household while the mayor's on the phone, shouting in Hebrew and in Arabic. The mayor is on the phone with the DCO, trying to tell them. He's cocking his gun at the mayor and pointing the guns at the kids. Don't you dare try to take my camera. The soldier just tried to take my camera because I took a picture of him, but he didn't get it. What happened earlier today, Nora, I'm trying to get in a place where you can hear me a little bit better. What happened about 15 minutes ago was that one Jeep entered the village. They've been doing this every night, where they enter the village and just park in an area. Sometimes they actually come out with whistles and start whistling and screaming to the youth in Arabic and in Hebrew, come out, you homosexuals, or fags is more likely a better translation. Come out, you fags. When Shabab or youth eventually come out or begin to throw stones, they use it as a precursor to invade homes.
When she sat down in the dirt in front of your machine, a lovely woman dressed in red, you in military green. If you had met her in Jerusalem, you might have asked her on a date. But here you were in Gaza, rolling towards the gate. As your foot went to the floor, did you recall her eyes? Did her gaze remind you that you've become what you despise? As you rolled on towards this woman and ignored all shouts to stop, did you feel a shred of doubt as you watched her body drop? As your caterpillar tracks upon her body pressed with 60 tons of deadly force, crushed the bones within her chest, could you feel the contours of her face as you took her life away? Did you serve your country well?
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. The power of AIPAC, the pro-Israeli lobby, is definitely expanding. The lobby's actions that led to the quick retreat of Chaz Freeman to be the next chair of the National Intelligence Committee demonstrate its current prowess and its ability to exert its power effectively at the highest levels of the U.S. government. After being appointed to the position by Admiral Dennis Blair, the Director of National Intelligence, the lobby swung into action. With its strong connections with the White House Chief of Staff, Rahm Emanuel, and Congressional Lobby frontman Charles Schumann, they made short work of Freeman and sent Admiral Blair running for cover. In withdrawing his name, Freeman did not mince words regarding the lobby's impact. He said, "Their outrageous agitation will be seen by many to raise serious questions about whether the Obama administration will be able to make its own decisions about the Middle East." Goes on to say, it cast doubt on its ability to consider, that's Obama's ability to consider, let alone decide what might best serve the United States rather than those of a lobby intent on enforcing the will of a foreign government. Joining us on the line right now is Ray McGovern. McGovern is a former U.S. Army intelligence officer and a high-level analyst for the Central Intelligence Agency. His article on this subject appeared yesterday on consortiumnews.com, and it is good, Ray McGovern, to have you back. First of all, let's talk about what the position is and just a thumbnail sketch on Chaz Freeman.
Good to be back with you, Dennis. This is really important stuff. I mean, I can't conceive of anything more important, at least from the intelligence point of view of our government. The position is the highest substantive officer sitting over 16 intelligence agencies. He's chair of the National Intelligence Council. It is the final body that approves not only national intelligence estimates, but the daily president's brief, the presidential daily brief served up to the president and his chief advisors 6 days a week. It could not be more important. Think of what would have happened if you had somebody in that position before Iraq instead of the malleable George Tenet. One other thing I'll add is that the estimate on how soon Iran could get a nuclear weapon, the one that was the bombshell, so to speak, no pun intended, in November of 07, the one that said that Iran had stopped, I repeat, had stopped the weapons-related research on its nuclear capability at the end, well, in the fall of 2003, so, you know, 5.5 years ago, that memo was prepared under the supervision of Tom Finger, who was the last head of the NIC. It was very gutsy, and it was the only one that I can recall that can legitimately be described as playing a huge role in preventing a wider war, namely an Israeli-U.S. war against Iran, which looked like it was very much in the cards 2 years ago. So these cannot be diminished in their significance, and the fellow heading this up was someone that was known to have independent views, nothing to lose, no special pleading for anyone, and universally regarded as about the best person you could possibly think of for this job.
Well, a lot of people did not think so, and most of them have the ear of the President of the United States. Now, we're talking about AIPAC. This is a very powerful lobby and exerting itself on this appointment. Now, listen here. Admiral Blair, who is the Director of National Intelligence, is no newcomer. Was he shocked when he appointed, or did he not realize when he appointed an independent person for this position with such power that he might not run into a roadblock? What happened here?
Well, Blair is a military type, okay? He's an admiral. And military commanders, and I know this from my own experience, you know, when they take command, they have the power to appoint their staff, to promote and demote. And he fully expected, in my view, this is my reconstruction of it, he said, all right, there may be head of national intelligence. It's a supreme leader here. Now, what I'll do is pick the very best guy who I know will give me objective, substantive briefings, and that would be Chess Freeman. So he appointed him. Now, what happened was someone in the innards of the national intelligence apparatus there leaked his appointment, or his upcoming appointment, to the likes of Rosen, Steve Rosen. Okay, who's Rosen? Well, he's the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee guru, the fellow with the most influence in Congress. And incidentally, he has just been indicted and is facing trial under the U.S. Espionage Act for giving secrets intended for Israel. Okay, now he's the guy that gets blogging right away 10 days before the actual appointment is announced, and he stirs up such a din that you know, a din full of false as well as accurate quotes taken completely out of context of things that Freeman had said in the past. And so he gets people like the malleable Nancy Pelosi beholden to considerable contributions from the Jewish community in the United States, gets her to say, oh, Freeman's views are beyond the pale, quote, beyond the pale, end quote. Well, what does that mean? Well, that means that Freeman's belief that we should have a more balanced attitude and more balanced policy in the Middle East, that we ought to go back to the time when we could be an honest broker in deed as well as name, that's, quote, beyond the pale, end quote. Well, it's beyond the pale for AIPAC, that's for sure. It's beyond the pale for very, very wealthy people who support the Israel lobby. And so we have a very, very insidious situation here where people who aspire to political office, or people who aspire to now to high positions in the U.S. intelligence apparatus as well as policy apparatus, that they have been given an object lesson. Look, you play ball with AIPAC or forget it. You're going to be on the bench.
Now, this is a very dangerous moment in history, and a lot of people like Benjamin Netanyahu, probably the next prime minister of Israel, is watching very closely. Talk a little bit about why this is a fragile moment and these actions are crucial around Freeman.
Well, even before Freeman was sort of dissed, Gareth Porter and I did a op-ed for the Miami Herald. You can find it on Tuesday. And what we're talking about is that, you know, here is a guy, Netanyahu, who has explicitly said that if we don't stop Iran, Iran will cause a, quote, holocaust against the Jewish people, end quote. He's made no bones of the fact that he prefers the Bush-Cheney-style preventive strike to all other policies. And so there is a very, very real possibility that if Netanyahu became the next prime minister in Israel, which seems to be pretty much a sure thing, that he would be looking at the U.S. Leadership and say, here's Obama. What did he do about the dissing of Chaz Freeman? Well, like Burr Fox, he didn't say nothing, right? He just hunkered down and didn't say nothing. Why? Because the AIPAC lobby is so strong. Now, deduction, AIPAC lobby so strong? Well, if we provoke the kind of incident that would really force Iran to retaliate against us, let's say we fly a few fighter bombers and we take out Natanz, or one of the nuclear-related facilities in Iran, if we do that, Iranians may rise to the occasion and retaliate in some way, and then the U.S. president will have no option, I repeat, no option, because of his sensitivity to the Israel lobby, to be in with both feet, as George Bush said he would. George Bush erroneously claimed that Israel is our ally. It is not, by the way, friends. There is no mutual defense treaty between Israel and the United States, and that is simply because mutual defense treaties of an international kind require clearly defined and recognized international borders, and there's no way that Israel wants to pull back from the occupied territories acquired by its attack in 1967. So that's the reason there is no mutual defense obligation. But if the president says there is one, at least for President Bush, there is one. And in fact, if AIPAC is so darn strong that they can have veto power over the chief intelligence substantive officer in our government, what does that tell Netanyahu? It's going to be a piece of cake. It's going to be a cakewalk. We'll start this war. We'll get the U.S. involved, and we'll take out the Iranian nuclear capability or set it back 3 years. Well, yeah, that is really, really dangerous, and that is, I'm afraid, the inescapable conclusion and some wishful thinking that Netanyahu is about to engage in. That's why Gareth Porter and I thought it necessary to find a vehicle that would speak to more than just the choir here and say, look, Mr. President, you've got to tell Netanyahu now, no way will we come in with both feet if you start a war with Iran.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Ray McGovern. He's a former U.S. Army intelligence officer and a former high-level CIA, Central Intelligence Agency analyst, advising presidents on foreign policy. Ray McGovern, we were concerned, and we were also highly criticized for going after Obama right away in terms of the positioning of Rahm Emanuel and certain other people who are very much associated with Israel and the Israeli lobby. But Rahm Emanuel played a key role in this operation, as did Schumer. Talk about, I mean, they're out there bragging as soon as they got rid of Freeman.
Well, I come from the Bronx, and the word we used there was chutzpah, okay?
Braggadocio?
Yeah, it's just overweening pride at having accomplished this task and having really intimidated Obama into silence. Now, my views on Obama have always been circumspect. I really, really resented him going along with that FISA revision and the business of letting the telecons off free. Rahm Emanuel is a disaster in his current position.
For people who don't know that, he's the chief of staff. He's one of the most powerful people in Washington now.
Exactly, and he's an Israeli citizen as well as a U.S. citizen. And when the 91 war happened, guess which side he fought on? Well, not on the Iraqi side, of course, but on Israel's side. He rejoined Israel's army. He's had a background.
Wait, he was fighting with Israel?
Yeah.
In an Israeli uniform?
Yeah. But the idea is, you know, he could have signed up for our army, right? But he went home to Israel and fought for them. So he is the typical dual national type that really can't distinguish between what he considers to be the strategic interests of Israel on the one hand and the strategic interests of America on the other. Now, some people call these people traitors. I don't call them traitors. I just call them really dumb. I call them very myopic. Because Israel's interests are not the same as ours, and if we let ourselves be guided by what we consider to be Israel's better judgment, it's going to be really, really bad for Israel, and not only the longer term, but in the medium term, because they're not going to be able to use violence to settle all their problems, and we need to tell them that.
Well, you know, Hillary Clinton was at this donors conference recently, and the recent Gaza war, you notice how Hillary Clinton and various people don't go to the Gaza Strip to see the devastation. They go to Israel for most of the time, then they make a quick stop in the West Bank in between Israeli invasions and house demolitions there, but they never go to the Gaza Strip. Well, we know Hillary Clinton's going to be running for president for the next 8 years, and to be president, you have to have AIPAC, the Israeli lobby, with you. You've got Rahm Emanuel in the White House. We saw Barack Obama, the first thing he did when he won the nomination to the president for the president was at 7 o'clock the next morning was groveling around AIPAC. So this is going to be probably a very dangerous and bloody time for Palestinians and for people who are hoping for peace in the region.
That unfortunately is true unless, and it's all capitals unless. I think we have the wherewithal and the will now to point to this episode as a flagrant abuse of power by AIPAC. And if they don't recognize that they're doing Israel harm by doing this, well, we do. Those of us need to speak out and speak out now, because this is really serious stuff. And I point to Netanyahu only as a specific near-term problem. Over the longer term, to the degree we continue to be identified completely with Israeli actions and behavior in the Middle East, we're going down the drain, because you know, Arabs, Muslims, the rest of the people watch that daily on their TV at night, and you know, our stature in the real world and our support in those countries has gone down the drain. Needs to be stopped.
All right. Ray McGovern, most recent article in consortiumnews.com, also an article with Garth Porter in the Miami Herald on Tuesday. Incredibly important information. The sacking, the pushing out of Chaz Freeman to be the next chairman of the National Intelligence Committee at a very crucial time is troubling. And we thank you for being on top of this, Ray McGovern.
You're most welcome, Dennis. Good talking to you.
Your mind lies in the devil's workshop. Evil doing's your thrill. And trouble and mischief is all you live for. You know done well, and that you go to hell. You go to hell. So you live in high. Rich off the fat of the land, just don't dispose of your natural soul, because you know done well that you'll go to hell.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. And we are joined again by Catherine Austin Fitz for our weekly segment called Community Business. Catherine, welcome back, and it's good always to have you with us on Flashpoints.
It's always good to be here.
All right, well, let's start with Bernie Madoff. Just an hour or two ago, he was in court. He pleaded guilty. He said he was very, very sorry about all the people that he hurt in what may be or may not be the largest, biggest single financial swindle. I doubt if it is, but
I doubt it.
It was certainly ugly, and a lot of people got hurt.
Yeah.
Now, we keep talking about one man, and of course, it makes sense that he goes from his penthouse to the jailhouse, but this was going on for a long time. Could it be there aren't other people who are engaged in this, whose names we might know all the way up the food chain?
There's no way that this could have been a Lone Ranger. It's impossible. And so the real question here, it's obvious from what's happened, Dennis, that they don't want any information coming out or any process that would illuminate for the public what's really going on here. So we've got a deal. We don't know what the deal is. My guess is it'll be interesting to see what happens to his family, is that he's taking the fall for everybody and everything, in exchange for his family getting taken care of. So it's just, if you've ever seen Godfather 3, you know how this works. So my guess is there's a deal, and what the powers that be want is for Manoff to take the fall and the truth to never see the light of day.
All right. So here's a swindle, $50, $100 billion. It's hard to figure it out. It happens on two or three continents. How many people do you need to pull this off? Can he do it alone?
I would think at a minimum you need the, you certainly need the Treasury and the intelligence agencies going along. You need one or both of those telling the SEC to stand down, which clearly had happened on one, if not more, occasion. And you need the New York authorities to stand down as well. So you clearly have something that, that had, and you need their banks. So we have big bankers involved with Madoff who are also going along. So this is a very, this is woven into the fabric of the biggest institutions on Wall Street in Washington. And it can't happen without air cover from some or all of them. Certainly, you know, the kind of air cover we've seen in situations like this is National Security Council and intelligence agency, you know, basically saying leave these guys alone. So we don't know what the true story is here, but what we know is there's a concerted effort for it to not come out. That we know from the press reports that, that the trustee has only recaptured about $1 billion, and there's now $68 billion, I think, missing. And if you look at Madoff's clientele, you have some pretty influential, powerful, serious people who I think are going to want to know what really happened.
Well, I certainly would like to know what really happened, and the listeners to this broadcast would like to know. But I do know this, that Madoff's operation included, you know, he's busted for money laundering, and he's busted for mail fraud, wire fraud. He's using the latest technology in communications at the international level. This is the technology that the Bush administration and administrations before that made a point of heavily monitoring. But in the last 8 and 10 years, this kind of communication was monitored at all levels of national intelligence. So what's going on?
You know, it used to always amaze me when I'd ask somebody, okay, now if we spend, well, now it's up to $600 billion a year on the military, and not one missile or soldier can cross the borders without setting off 500 alarms. How is it that thousands of truckloads of drugs get back and forth every year? So the reality is this stuff can't happen without major institutional knowledge and support. It just can't.
And how many times would he or the people working for him have to so-called, they're saying that he committed perjury and gave false filings to the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission over a 10 or a 15-year, $100 billion operation? How many false statements? How many times does he have to file statements with how many different people? How could none of these people, I'm sorry, I'm going on here, but it's extraordinary.
But well, what's extraordinary is that anyone can say, you know, can propose the Lone Ranger explanation. This is sort of the lone assassin. This is the financial equivalent of the lone assassin, that anybody could continue to put forward that theory with a straight face. I mean, it just, it's a little bit like me saying that you lived your life in Berkeley for a month, but no one ever saw you. You were completely invisible. Well, how could that be? You know, it's kind of like saying somebody went without eating for 10 years. You know, I mean,
you're listening. I could probably get away with that and still be overweight. But anyway, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. We're speaking with Catherine Austin Fitz. She is our translator from Wall Street to Main Street. And speaking about Main Street, Catherine, foreclosures are up some 6% in the last quarter or months. And they're expecting many, many more. Yesterday we did a story. There's over 1.5 million homeless children out on the street now. And the people we were speaking to were saying with these foreclosures, we can expect another 2 million kids on the street. What's this looking like to you?
Well, and it's very concentrated. In fact, California is one of the worst places in terms of foreclosures. The housing recession has not yet started, Dennis. We've had the burst of a bubble, and now we're watching significant layoffs. And traditionally in a recession, you get the layoffs, and after the layoff cycle through the economy, you get a housing recession. And I would expect that housing recession to hit this summer. So we are, I was saying last week that we're about 50% through the workout or shakeout process, and I just read a statement by the head of the Singapore Wealth Sovereign Fund who said we're only 30% of the way through. But we have much to integrate and incorporate, and the reality is we have an economy that's kept going with government money and government credit and debt. It's not fundamentally productive, and so until we change and become fundamentally productive, this is going to continue to happen.
Well, like all the pro-banker presidents, all the bailout presidents, all the presidents that have supported a war economy, it does appear that President Barack Obama is doing a lot of the same things and assuming that you can put people to work through the defense industry and through war. You want to talk a little bit? I get phone calls, and people would call these people conspiracy nuts, but like I just took a message here before we started speaking from a listener who said that, I'm sick. Here is Obama supporting the sort of the model, the sort of control the world, control all the resources by war model of administration, and to do it, he's busy funding all the banks and all the institutions that make money on war. What do you say to this caller?
It's true. It's absolutely true. For 500 years, we've had something called the central banking warfare model, and since 1980, really since World War II, technology has taken it to a whole new sort of venal level, and what we're watching is economic warfare globally, where people hold, we're the reserve currency globally, and we're the reserve currency globally because we have the force, we have the warfare machinery to force people to take our securities and our currency, even though they continue to drop in value. So this is the model, and this is the model that sustains our cash flows of almost every household and certainly every community in the country. And we've talked before about my red button story, which is really just a story that describes the extent to which there's popular support to do whatever you have to do to keep the cash flows coming. And it's going to, the one thing we need to change this is everyone in America and worldwide to say, you know something? We don't want the cash flows to continue to be generated with more government debt and crazy government spending. We want to stop. We're prepared to say no. Let's not keep the short-term cash coming, and let's stop doing the things we need to do militarily to force people to subsidize this, because the first world is basically destroying the second and third world to get this month's cash fix. And if you look at the budget, Dennis, it's very simple. We get $1 trillion from individual taxes, and then we get more than $1 trillion from basically forcing people to buy our paper all around the world, and then we give the money to the banks and the military. I mean, that's our model.
And ultimately, that's what's got us into the crash mode.
Right, but let me tell you where it's going if we don't change it. Because the risk is not that our economy slows down. I have a new article called The Data Beast. You can link to it from my blog, and what it describes is the Bush administration and now the Obama administration's proposal for a healthcare database. And this literally is, the mark of the beast. This is implementing the information technology we need to put a chip into every human being in this country.
Talk a little bit more about that, because you've been on to this, and it is incredibly worrisome in the context of, we talked about Big Brother, this takes it, puts it on steroids.
Right. What we're talking about doing is taking the most intimate personal data on each person in the country and putting it in a database that technically is owned and controlled by the government. But if you look at, who will have access to it, you're talking about the most powerful, I would say, shadow government / secret societies in the world. And what that means is they can aggregate this data with all the other financial data. They can require doctors to hold data in digital form. They can cut off your health care by simply fiddling with your doctor in a variety of different ways. If somebody in the upper echelons needs a transplant and you just happen to fit the profile, I ask you, how long do you think it's going to be till you have an accident?
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. All right, Catherine, I want to talk to you about an interesting lecture that Seymour Hersh gave the other day, and it's got everybody's attention. It's not about an article he's written yet, but he's working on a book, and I guess he was talking about, you could say, an executive assassination ring. And he was talking about essentially under the radar U.S. hit squad, young people going in, kidnapping, torturing, and killing. And it has sort of a corporate flavor to it. And as I read on and listened, we're going to see if we can get a little sound from that. But I thought about the kinds of situations that you faced, Catherine, as a former high-level official in a presidential administration. Did you catch Hersh, and what was your response?
I wasn't surprised at all when I made the mistake of trying to oppose the housing bubble and warn people about it. I literally ended up in litigation with the federal government and dealt with very significant amounts of physical harassment and surveillance during the same period that Hersh is describing. In 2004, I wrote a letter to Condoleezza Rice about 9/11 that got picked up by UPI and was caused consternation to the administration. And then in June 14th, I had litigation against the federal government. We won the big case in the Court of Claims on June 14th. And I got a signal from my lawyers that the Department of Justice wanted to settle, so I had arranged a Swiss bank account because I didn't want the money in the U.S. I just was concerned that once we won and if anybody had to pay us, they'd just, you know, pull another dirty trick. So I faxed the signature pages back to the Swiss on June 16th, and suddenly, Dennis, for the next 2 days, Halliburton was the number one user on my website by a huge amount. And then that third day, I was poisoned very badly. Some of my doctors think they were trying to kill me.
You were poisoned?
Yeah.
What was the poison?
We don't know. I was poisoned four times during the litigation. Three were arsenic, and the fourth was probably a lead concoction. We can't figure it. You know, we know what my tests show. The normal lead content is 1.7 times, and mine is, my original was 47. My nutritionist couldn't believe I could even walk. You know, when things like that happen, you're busy trying to, you know, survive. You're not remembering, oh, you know, how can I document this? These aren't the kind of things you can document or talk to anybody about, or you can't call the local police. You can't go see the Department of Justice. You're in a situation, which we're all in, which is the government is no longer the authorities we go to when we're in danger. They're the sheriff of Nottingham, and we need to run and hide from them and protect our assets from them.
Well, I can tell you this dialogue between Seymour Hersh and others was troubling. And here's just some of what he said.
So it's one of those stories that should have changed, should have, could have, would have changed the way the intelligence community operated. But I'm here to tell you that it really did not in the long run. It did some good things, but things happen.
And do they continue to happen to this day?
Yep. After 9/11, I haven't written about this yet, but the Central Intelligence Agency was very deeply involved in domestic activities against people they thought to be enemies of the state without any legal authority for it. They haven't been called on it yet. That does happen. Right now, today, there was a story in the New York Times that, if you read carefully, mentioned something known as the Joint Special Operations Command, JSOC it's called, is a special wing of our special operations community that is set up independently. In the Bush-Cheney days, they reported directly to the Cheney office. They do not report to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff or to Mr. Gates, the Secretary of Defense. They report directly to him. Congress has no oversight of it. It's an executive assassination wing, essentially. And it's been going on and on and on. And just today in the Times, there was a story saying that its leader, a three-star admiral named McRaven, ordered a stop to certain activities because there were so many collateral deaths under President Bush's authority. They've been going into countries, not talking to the ambassador or to the CIA station chief, and finding people on a list and executing them and leaving. That's been going on, well, in the name of all of us. It's complicated because the guys doing it are not murderers. And yet they are committing what we would normally call murder. It's a very complicated issue because they're young men who went into the special forces, the Delta Force that you've heard about, Navy SEAL teams, highly specialized, in many cases the best and the brightest, really, no exaggeration, really fine guys that went in to do the kind of necessary jobs they think you need to protect America, and then they find themselves torturing people. And I've had people say to me, 5 years ago I had one say, what do you call it when you interrogate somebody and you leave him bleeding and then you don't let him have any medical care and 2 days later he dies? Is that murder? What happens if I get before a committee? But they're not going to get before a committee, I don't think.
If you're going to run a highly centralized economic model, this is what you have to do to force people to do things that are uneconomic. And why would anybody buy billions of dollars of treasuries when they're going down in value? You wouldn't unless, you know, it's like the movie Syriana, a missile will jump on your head if you don't. So that's why it's so important that we convert to more sustainable economics, because the only way to keep this model going is with this kind of force and terror.
All right. And the other way that you keep the model going is you make sure you have the mainstream press on your side, regurgitating, being good stenographers, and not asking any of the questions of the people who are at the centers of power, whether it's in the corporations or in the government. And in that regard, believe me, I'm building up to a question here, Catherine. I was listening to three or four of the CNN advisors, taking questions from the audience about foreclosures and dealing with banks. And one of the questions was from a listener who said, well, now I've heard all about these problems that Citibank is having. Is there any reason, though, because they have some good deals and mortgage stuff, is there any reason why I shouldn't do business with Citibank? And of course the advisor said, absolutely not. They're solid. And even if they're taken over, the people who take them over will be responsible to deal with you. Catherine, you want to respond to that?
There's only one kind of enforcement that's going to have effect, and that's called good old-fashioned shunning. If someone can steal your money, harm your neighbor, lie, cheat, steal money from the government, and you consider them socially acceptable and acceptable to do business with, then you get a criminal society, and this is how we got here.
All right. I think we're going to leave it on that upbeat note. If people want to find out more about what Catherine Weston Fitz is doing, they can go to her website, solari.com. Catherine, as always, a pleasure to have you with us.
Thanks so much, Dennis.
Throw the spotlight back on Haiti, where poverty is still the pandemic, as Haitians continue to suffer from oppressive U.S. policies. It's been 5 years since the U.S. Overthrew the Haitian democracy and exiling the duly constituted president, Jean-Bertrand Aristide. Indeed, on the ground in Haiti, people are hungry and in need of support. Instead of punishing policies of the World Bank and the IMF, 1 week ago, 10,000 people took to the streets on the anniversary of the U.S.-backed coup. And again today, over 15,000 people met a delegation led by Ban Ki-moon and Bill Clinton in Port-au-Prince. Meanwhile, human rights activists are calling for a temporary protected status for Haitians and to cease from all deportations. We're going to talk about the controversy around that. And joining us to talk about all of this and the very difficult situation on the ground is Flashpoint Special Correspondent Kevin Pina. Pina also teaches media at Cal State East Bay. Kevin, welcome back to Flashpoints. First of all, let's start with the news, which we're not hearing anywhere. Talk about what's going on.
Right now, as we're speaking, there are about 5,000 protesters still in front of Haiti's National Palace. This began earlier this afternoon when Ban Ki-moon, Bill Clinton, and Wyclef Jean arrived. They were met with 15,000 protesters who tried to follow the route. They finally went to the palace where this large, massive crowd finally rallied in front of the palace. One of the protesters I spoke to today on the radio, a woman who I wasn't able to get her name, she said, listen, we supported Bill Clinton. We think he's a great guy, but if he's going to give his charity, the only charity we want him to offer us is to return our president, Jean-Bertrand Aristide.
These thousands of people on the ground now are on the ground for a lot of reasons. Maybe set the scene a little bit. 5 years after the coup, what can we say about the country then and what it's looking like now in terms of the key issues?
It's a very different Haiti today than it was under Jean-Bertrand Aristide. Remember that Bill Clinton actually is part of the root of this, and it's sort of an irony that he's visiting Haiti today. Remember that it was Bill Clinton's administration that forced Aristide to accept terms of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank in exchange for stopping the killing following the coup of 1991. In 1994, the Haitian military had become a killing machine. It was killing for many reasons. One was to forestall any discussion of Aristide's return, but it was also killing because they had transformed Haiti into the major transshipment point of cocaine bound for the United States during that period. Basically, the Haitian military under Clinton, many of whom we knew were on the CIA payroll till the end, actually oversaw the change from the Medellin cocaine cartel to the Cali cocaine cartel. That happened in Haiti. But the point is that as the Haitian military began to eat itself alive over cocaine profits, the Clinton administration was forced to intervene to save that institution. But as part of its bargaining chip against Aristide for his return, they also shoved down his throat these so-called neoliberal economic reforms. And I think probably our listeners know what the roots of that are. Ronald Reagan, trickle-down economics. Well, it was also exported as part of our foreign policy. And really, what its main message was is the only way to help the poor in other parts of the world was to create more business opportunities for the wealthy. Well, Aristide was forced to sign on to that in order to stop the killing in 1994. And what it said was, of course, the basic tenets, which were Haiti owns several state-run enterprises like the cement factory, the flour mills, the telephone company, the electrical company. Well, you're supposed to put those on the auction block under these policies, right? Aristide had agreed to. You're supposed to sell them to the highest builder, who are who? Usually the only people who have the capital to buy them, of course, are your own local elites who are already millionaires and billionaires in partnership with multinational corporations in Canada and the United States. And then you sell your telephone company, your electric company on the cheap. That renders them huge profits, which they then in theory are supposed to reinvest into your country, creating better paying jobs. Well, nonsense. Aristide sold the flour mill. He sold the cement factory, but he held onto the two jewels in the crown, the telephone company and the electrical company. Now, the second tenet that Aristide had agreed to under neoliberal economics was that you're never supposed to take profits from your government-run industries and reinvest them into so-called social programs. Well, Aristide did just that. Not only did he refuse to sell the telephone company and the electric company, he then took profits from them and he invested them in a universal literacy project where every adult between the age of 30 to 60 could get a free literacy class every day. But more than that, he also created what were called the literacy restaurants, or the alpha restos, which were the true safety net of the poor, serving millions of meals. For an adult can, less than 18 cents, you could get a hot meal, but more than that, also millions of vitamin supplements, especially to Haiti's most vulnerable, who are children who are suffering of malnutrition. Well, under Aristide's government, literacy was almost halved, malnutrition was almost unheard of, but we know that that is exactly what was destroyed by that coup more than 5 years ago. We know that rather than understanding what Aristide did with the telephone company and the electrical company, we've got voices out there who've tried to accuse him of corruption, when in fact, what Aristide did was commit two very big no-nos and running against neoliberal economics. One, never refuse to privatize your state-run industries. Two, never ever take profits from them and invest them in so-called social programs. Well, you remember the food riots last April, 2008. Those couldn't have happened under Aristide's government because they were there exactly for that reason, to serve as a safety net for the poorest of the poor in the most lean of times. Well, right now, you don't have a government in Haiti that can even prioritize its own budget. René Préval recently admitted that the current government when he was in Washington meeting with Hillary Clinton that not a single penny of international aid, over $4 billion of it, goes directly to the Haitian government. All of it passes through the hands of non-governmental organizations. It is estimated almost 80% go to administrative funds. There is an NGO involved in every aspect of decision-making, policy production inside of Haiti today.
Kevin, let's talk about Lavalas. Lavalas is the majority party of President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. As you say, you know, over 5 years ago, the Bush administration came in, overthrew the government, and purged it of its duly constituted leadership. That party of Aristide is Lavalas. We now have a provisional election council that won't recognize the majority party. What's this about and what's the significance?
Well, people who've listened to this show over the years know that after 2004, we began reporting almost exclusively about the slaughter in the streets of Port-au-Prince, how the international community and the United Nations were backing the Haitian police as they were going into poor neighborhoods, and they were committing summary executions of Lavalas supporters as they were arresting en masse, creating thousands of political prisoners, forcing thousands into exile, internal and external. Basically, at the end of 2006, you had thousands of Lavalas supporters who were either murdered, jailed, or forced into exile. A killing machine, basically. And the intent was very clear. The mission of the United States, Canada, and France, and ultimately the United Nations, was to eliminate through violence that political movement, Jean-Bertrand Aristide's Lavalas political party. Well, if this is a war of attrition, the people of Haiti are winning, because despite that killing machine, just last week, 10,000 people took to the streets again demanding Aristide's return. Today, 15,000 people met Bill Clinton and Ban Ki-moon again with one unified voice saying, return President Aristide, release Lavalas political prisoners, end this second phase of this nightmare. The point being that if this is a war of attrition, Lavalas is winning. What's beginning to happen is that the cracks in the big lie, the lie that said that Aristide had lost the popular support of the Haitian people, the lies that allowed Guy Philippe and these paramilitaries to come across and use military force from the Dominican Republic to seize townships and kill Lavalas officials, the lies that said that Aristide was a corrupt despot, cracks are beginning to show in the coalition, in the international community that foisted that lie upon us in order to justify Aristide's ouster, while at the same time, the movement supporting Aristide Lavalas, the majority of the poor in Haiti, has only continued to grow stronger throughout this. Despite all of those killings, all of those jailings, they never let go of that reality, that commitment to the truth. And today we're seeing it manifested once again in the streets of Port-au-Prince. Haiti has gotten discernibly worse. Malnutrition has risen by almost 20%. Infant mortality has risen by almost 20%. And illiteracy in that country has risen by almost 20% since they ousted Jean-Bertrand Aristide in February 2004. That's exactly what they don't want people to know, because they built it upon a lie. And it's one thing to control a country militarily through a UN occupation, it's quite another to have the consent of the governed. What the Haitian people have seen, where this disillusion has really come from, is that after more than $4 billion in so-called international assistance, the lives of the Haitian people have not bettered discernibly in any way.
Let's talk back to Clinton today. What is he actually trying to do there with Ban Ki-moon? What, stemming the blood tide that was caused by the coup? And is Ban Ki-moon there to try and cover up the fact that the United Nations enforced the coup?
I think that that's absolutely part of it. I don't see how else to look at it. Remember that when Bill Clinton was president and he returned Aristide in 94, this was not to restore democracy. As I told you, the reason that Clinton really intervened was to keep the Haitian military from eating itself alive, destroying itself over cocaine trafficking. Clinton never disarmed the Haitian military after Aristide disbanded them. Clinton never disarmed the CIA-created Front for Advancement and Progress, the CIA-created death squad in Haiti that was responsible for thousands of rapes, murders, and torturing of Haitian citizens. No, quite the contrary. Those were always kept in reserve. These were part of the same people who regathered under Bush and came and were training in the Dominican Republic, who then came over in early February 2004 and began seizing townships and killing people, just heinous murders. Clinton has not always been the stalwart of democracy in Haiti that he's been presented as in the international press. These guys, Clinton, Wyclef Jean, and Ban Ki-moon, represent the status quo. There's not going to be any change in policy if they get their way for what they're calling. They're calling for more aid money, more charity for the Haitians so that they can become more dependent upon the international community rather than allow them to have their political independence so they can run their own affairs based on their own priorities as they did prior to February 29th, 2004.
It really is an amazing thought, if you will, if Barack Obama, who says that he wants to reverse crushing Bush policies, imagine if he said, okay, we're going to do everything in our power to bring back the duly constituted president of Haiti, Jean-Bertrand Aristide.
There's no indications that President Obama's going in that direction at all. I didn't see.
But there must have been hope on the ground in Haiti.
Well, there was some hope, but I got to tell you, it was really dashed recently. I told you that Rene Préval a couple weeks ago had met with Secretary of State Hillary Clinton in Washington. The very next day, the Provisional Election Council barred Lavalas, the majority political party, from participating in the upcoming senatorial elections on procedural grounds, said that the documentation had to have President Aristide's signature as the leader of the party on each of the candidates' applications. Now, of course, the real hypocrisy in that is that in 2006, when they needed Lavalas to legitimize the elections of Préval, they didn't demand the same thing. I don't think it's an accident that that decision by Haiti's Provisional Election Council came one day after Rene Préval meeting with Hillary Clinton in Washington, D.C. And if that's any indication of President Obama's policy towards Haiti, then I don't think that people in Haiti are going to count on him for much when it comes to returning Jean-Bertrand Aristide. It would be wonderful it happened, but we're looking at real indicators on the ground.
All right, we've got 45 seconds. Why is the United States government still so intimidated by the Haitian people, their quest for democracy, and their belief in Jean-Bertrand Aristide? What's the deal?
It doesn't matter why at this point. The real issue is that they have not been able to destroy it. They tried to destroy it through violence. Now they're trying to destroy it by not allowing it to participate in free and fair elections because they know that Lavalas would win those elections, and they will not allow that to happen. And the real question is, when is the United States going to allow real democracy where Haitians can set their own priorities based upon their own needs, and Haitians can really run Haiti again?
Award-winning investigative reporter, teacher Kevin Pina, a winner of the Project Censored Award last year. It's extraordinary. That's why you listen to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Stay tuned.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein and Nora Barrows-Friedman. Our contributing producer is Robert Knight. Our interim technical director is Eric Klein. And our production assistants are Emily Howard and Evelina Molina. Our Friday co-host is Francisco Herrera. Miguel Molina is our roving producer, and JR and the Block Report contribute to this program. Amanda Bellerby is our environmental producer and also produces the weekly Best of Flashpoints. To comment on today's program or to subscribe to our Fight Back email list, please contact us at flashpoints@kpfa.org. You can look us up on the web at www.flashpoints.net for our archived shows. Many thanks to our web team, and thank you for listening. Music this week, Nina Simone with Go to Hell, and David Rovics, The Death of Rachel Corrie. I'm Amanda Bellerby for Flashpoints.